This episode of the Paddock Pass podcast is brought to you by Renthal Street. From race to adventure, custom to naked, look no further than Renthal Street for handlebars, clip-ons, chains, and sprockets.
They said it couldn't be done, but BMW has won again in World SBK, and Top Rack has reminded us just how special a rider he really is. Winning races on a Kawasaki and a Yamaha was expected of him, but to win his fourth and his fifth races in World SBK in the BMW, it really surprised the whole paddock. It was also the manner in which he won those races. It's given us a lot to talk about on this week's Superbike Show with the Paddock Pass podcast presented by Renthal Street. I'm Steve English, and as ever on our Superbike shows, I'll be joined by Gordon Ritchie and Ivo Schutzbeck. And Gordo, this was a special weekend for us all.
Oh, indeed. And not just us. It was one of those weekends where other people started noticing what was going on and were all raving about it. So you got to think that's a positive thing. It doesn't always happen. And the racing was generally fantastic. Some of the best racing we've seen in one or two of the races, and close competitive racing in the rest, even if it wasn't quite the same excitement as the Super Pole race, which would be difficult to replicate every race. Not a fantastic weekend, and a great racetrack. I think everybody that was expecting a good weekend got it, and there was a bit of surprise everywhere.
Ivo Schutzbeck from speedweek.com. Ivo, you've been at the heart of the BMW journey over the last, well, let's take it back 10 years, and then their comeback into the series. You've had to write sometimes where you've had to be pretty harsh on BMW because they've warranted it, but now they get to have the rewards because this was such a surprising result, especially at a track where Top Rack hadn't won before. BMW were expected to be fast, maybe for the Super Bowl race, but not to manage their tyre the way they did. This was a massive story.
Yeah, hi, Stephen. I wouldn't call it harsh. I would call it honest. And I was always very honest with BMW. I had the pleasure to have an exclusive interview with Mr. Markus Flasch, who is the new CEO from BMW. And I mean, this was the perfect day for him to visit, first time in his life, World Superbike, because as you said, we had the two wins from Top Rack, and it was not just a win, it was a win in Top Rack style.
Just from that interview, Ivo, obviously there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of weeks since that hiring that BMW are looking at MotoGP, the new technical ranks for next year. Gordo, I know you also spoke to about this, but when you look at how the land lies, I'll come to you first, Gordo, actually, because BMW has always said they need to win in Superbikes first before they can look anywhere else, or even you go back further, and they always said MotoGP was just a good marketing tool for them. They have the safety cars, no need for anything else. But the reg change is coming up. Could make it a little bit more interesting, a little bit more appealing for them.
Yeah, there's two main things at play here. One, there will be regulation changes, which means that they would be starting on the same footing as everybody else if they were to go. And also, it does seem that this guy seems to be more keen on going. I think he will be pushing it. Right, from reading between the lines, he was slightly non-committal, but he certainly wasn't saying he weren't, doesn't want to go. But I think he would be actively pushing it if I had to judge what the guy was saying in the round and read between the lines. But that does depend on how they do in Superbike. They've already had success. You can call winning when they weren't expected to with Top Rack this early. You can definitely see that was a kind of level. They've reached a point already. So they can actually maybe start thinking, we can do this. The only reason it stopped them in the past is money. When they've taken the idea to the board, they've looked at it, and however many tens of millions you have to spend to start to be competitive in MotoGP and then continue to be for years afterwards and reap the benefits if you build a good bike and have good riders, it just was untenable. It just didn't make any financial sense. You know, it didn't make any sense whatsoever, even for a huge company like BMW, who aren't run by one person. So that, to me, is the big thing. If the board go for it, the BMW will probably go to MotoGP. If they don't, then they won't.
Yeah, because Evo, that is one of the big things. BMW made the decision to go into Formula One and then pulled out very quickly, just in terms of when the decision's made, it's made to be as big as possible for as long as they want it to be. But to go to MotoGP is a huge investment. But obviously with technical rules changing in another couple of years' time, they've got a window that gives them the chance to get in there and at least give themselves a chance to be able to be competitive.
I see two things. Gordon is completely right. It makes sense if you go to MotoGP then in 27. All the bosses in BMW are normally for 4 to 5 years on their chairs. So first, they need to win in World Superbike. Then they need to make the decision to go to MotoGP. Then they need to finance it, and then they need to build a prototype. So this means when they are going to MotoGP, probably the boss from today is not any longer there. So this means they need to convince all the guys in the board that they make a decision which lasts for, let's say, 10 years or even longer, because it will take them some years to have success in MotoGP. And as you said, Formula One, Rally Dakar, German Touring Car Championship, BMW arrived and they went away again. So, and the MotoGP is not so easy because it's a massive investment, like not like Formula One, but I mean, it's quite expensive.
Yeah, definitely a lot more expensive than a World Superbike program. We'll obviously come back to BMW in a couple of moments' time, but we're going to follow a slightly different structure to our Superbike shows through this year. Just because we got Evo on, we have three voices against. We're going to be a little bit more like our MotoGP show as well. So we'll kick it off straight away. Evo, your grade from this weekend out of 10, what was your grade for the Catalunya round?
I would say 8 out of 10, just because the second race was not so spectacular. The second main race. First race, sprint race, wow, outstanding. 10 out of 10.
I thought they were 11 out of 10, to be honest. But Gordo, what about you? What was your grade?
Yeah, I would go 9. I would take it as 9, because lots of things happened this weekend. It wasn't just those amazing races. Supersport was great. 300s was great. I could give it 5 out of 10 for the facilities because they're revamping the track and unfortunately it's a bit of a mess and it wasn't very happy and yeah, there was a few problems. Overall I'd give it 9 because things were so spectacular. I'd go 9 out of 10.
Yeah,
there can always be something improved, but yeah, I'd have to like think long and hard about how you could really ask for a better weekend, the racing than that.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that when you're racing in a building site, you need to have great races. And we had that for race one and race two. Race one and the Super Bowl race. Race two, not quite the same, but at least it was still interesting in a way that a lot of races in Catalunya haven't really been at that level either. So for me, I'm actually probably a little bit lower than you guys, maybe a 7, rather 7.5 for me. But Evo, what about your moment of the weekend? What was the standout?
I would go for the Toprak win in the first race, simply because it was the first BMW win in a long race since around 11 years. Even more spectacular was his win in the Super Pole race when he catched Bautista just in the last corner of the last lap. I mean, it was breathtaking.
Yeah, it was one of those things that Michael van der Mark afterwards said that Toprak makes the impossible possible. And this weekend was definitely one of those things. Gordo, what about you? What was your moment of the weekend?
Well, obviously the same one. But I'm not allowed to have it because Evo got in there before me. I'm going to say the arrival in the paddock of QJ. I'm going to say the arrival of another manufacturer who sees Superbike as a way into making themselves more, even if the bike is clearly off the pace and so on. It's a first attempt. But the fact that they've turned up adding another manufacturer to the already oversubscribed Supersport, to me, might be the thing we're talking about in the longer term, might be the thing we remember more, if it works out the way they hope it does.
Yeah, I think similar for that COVID success this weekend for me in the 300 class to take the first pole position, take their first podium. I thought for a Chinese manufacturer like QJ as well, it's really important to be able to open up new markets like that. And I think especially at a time whenever, obviously the championship this year has one flyaway, you're off Australia and then everything else in Europe. You kind of hope that with these Chinese manufacturers having an interest that down the line, we're going to have the opportunity to get back to China as well. So for me, that was probably my moment of the weekend. But when we look at the weekend as a whole, Evo, this is a weekend where tires dominated. This was all about being able to manage your tire life. And I found it really interesting that in Friday practice, the biggest issue for everyone was the front tire. After 6, 7, 8 laps for a lot of riders, the front was really giving out. And we're so used to this being a rear tire dominated track. And obviously in the races, this is still what was a big deciding factor. But this is a place where I was speaking to Andrew Pitt about it, and Pitt said that this is a place where you pay your bill in the last five laps. If you go out hard at the start, you're going to have nothing at the end. And this is where you have to manage it really well. And that was really the big factor in, say, Top Rat's race one success.
I agree that it was the big factor, and it because of this, we saw very exciting racing. But in general, talking about tires, for me, this is the most boring thing in the world because they are black, round, and from Pirelli. So, okay, you need to handle it. Some did it very good, others not. And this was the reason in the end why Top Rat could catch Bulega in the last laps, because in the last two laps, he was over 2.5 seconds faster than the Italian guy. So, yeah, simple story.
And Gordo, what about you, though? Obviously, Evo doesn't like to talk about tyres, but I'm going to force you to talk about tyres.
I think that obviously the things went the opposite from what we all expected, and I do mean everybody. They thought the Ducatis would be the ones able to nurse the tyres better at the end, and everybody else would drop back. And we saw some pretty clear examples of people going too fast, Sam Lowes for starters going too fast, coming back, etc. But ultimately, I think the difference wasn't anything to do with it. Yes, it was to do with the tyres, because obviously Bulega's tyre was done when he got hunted down by Top Rat. And that's part of the story, but I also think that maybe no other rider except Top Rat would have made that much progress already with his tyre pretty done. I think that was another Top Rat special. I don't know if many other riders would be able to take out that much in the last couple of laps. But the tyre, I mean, we brought two new tyres. You know, Pirelli bring new tyres sometimes. People think that they're on the same thing all the time. They don't. It's actually becoming something that people are, we might have to start rethinking about bringing faster and faster tyres, because it's fairly obvious the championship's going to have to slow down in our own terms and because of external pressure. So all this pushing for greater performance. We look at the pole time. You know, five riders underneath the 39s and 10 riders under the previous Super Pole best, the track best lap. Do we need to put all this much effort into development tyres in a single mate championship where we need to really be kind of at least attenuating the need to go faster and faster? Evo.
Johnny Reyes said a very interesting thing in Barcelona. He mentioned that this is, for him, that this is the wrong way to go, simply because I understand that Pirelli is developing tires in World Superbike and they want to be faster and all the riders want to be faster. But the problem is on a racetrack like Barcelona, where you have such a low grip level, is that in reality, the riders are not really racing. They are riding and they try to survive. In the last couple of laps, then we see maybe some proper racing because some tire is left. But on a normal race track like Assen, for example, they can go flat out from first to last lap. And simply the fastest rider is winning the race. And this is something we haven't seen in Barcelona because tactic was so important. And Andrea Iannona said, oh, tactic, tactic, tactic. Everyone is just talking about tactic. And he said he hates tactic. He's a racer. He want to go as fast as possible. And I understand this. So maybe it would be more clever from Pirelli to be 1 or 2 seconds slower and have proper racing instead of tactics.
I think it's one of those things, Evo, where Pirelli are so obsessed with the lap record. And everyone sees, oh, superbikes are closer and closer to a MotoGP time, so therefore the bikes are really impressive. Everyone's making a massive step. But realistically, there was a 6-second delta from the pole time to Bulega at the end of the race. Could you imagine a MotoGP race where there was 6 seconds between the pole time and your pace at the end of the race? It's just, you wouldn't see it. And that's where MotoGP is faster. Like a superbike can be super over one lap, but to do 20 laps around somewhere like that, it doesn't have the tire to do it. And I think it's one of those things where people can be a little bit, I don't want to say naive, but they look at the immediate lap time and they don't see that a MotoGP bike is faster because for every single lap of the 20 lap race it's faster, and by the end of the race it's a lot faster. So I think that it's one of those things where I kind of like to see it if we moved away from the Q tire, and that was how we were able to control superbikes from a regulation perspective.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I basically agree with it. The thing is, though, there is a really fundamental difference in the Pirellis that are used in World Superbike and any other tyre manufacturer's product. They use simple materials, everyday materials, so that they can sell them to people, exactly the same tyres, to people on track days, to professional racers, to amateur racers, to everybody else, and actually make some money, you know, and that's why Pirelli took it on. With the rise and rise of track days, people are buying several Pirelli tyres a year rather than one set of Pirellis for their 600 or their 1000cc sports bike or sports tour or anything else. People are going to track days and using lots of sets of tyres a year. That's why we went to slicks. Why would you go slicks in a production championship? Well, because that's what people want to run on track days and feel like they're racing, and to supply all the race categories and people who want to buy tyres to go racing at club level. So that's why they did it. So it's a big step to try and change a philosophy, which means that you will end up on the tracks that are very hard on tyres, with tyre issues at the end, or certainly a drop off of pace at the end. We also go to some tracks on the calendar where the Pirellis are going fast at lap 15, 16. It just depends on the track, but the tracks that are harder on tyres, certainly what you say is absolutely right.
Yeah, I think for me, it's kind of just like if we had the X tyre as our softer tyre, I think I'd be pretty happy with that. And we just didn't have the Q tyre. It also is one of those sustainability moves that a lot of series have moved away from qualifying tyre as well. But I found it really interesting chatting to Toprak on Sunday morning. I was just walking up through the paddock after parking the car, bumped into Toprak outside BMW Hospitality, and we were just chatting about how he built up his race. And I don't know what he said to you guys after Saturday's race, but he said to me that with the Pirelli tyre, he knew that on lap 15, he had a chance to win the race, or lap 14, he had a chance to win the race. But he also knew if he just immediately dropped his pace, the tyre would just destroy itself. So he had to incrementally build up his pace in those last couple of laps. And then with 2.5, 3 laps to go, that's whenever he was in super pole mode. But for 2 or 3 laps before that, it was just a case of, okay, I have to just gradually get a little bit faster. Otherwise, I'll just burn through the rubber, almost out of a state of shock for the tyre, it seemed.
Funnily enough, I bumped into him in exactly the same manner coming out of the car park on Sunday, I think it was, sometime Sunday, and asked him about it. And he said, look, if I have tyre for tyre, like the same as the other guy, he says, I always fancy my chances of winning. He says, I always think I'm going to be there or thereabouts for the win. And that was a big surprise that for some reason, a bike which is usually quite hard on tyres at the end of races, suddenly has become better. One setup, sure, but you can't change the whole character and nature of a bike overnight. So that's why I said earlier, and I think it's true, that I think Toprak just made more of his tyre. Bulliger's tyre was done in the race where he ran him down, and Bulliger says that, Toprak says that. Everybody knew what was going to happen, but I still think you had to be Toprak to guarantee winning that race the way you did.
Look, the point is for me that we are talking now since 10 minutes about tyres, and it shouldn't be the tyre which is deciding the race.
It wasn't. It was Toprak.
Agree. But in the end, the whole weekend was completely dictated by tyres. We saw, for example, Sam Lowes. He was super fast. You know, he was leading a race. He showed an excellent job until, unfortunately, he crashed. But why was he so fast? Because there was no tactic for Sam. He just went as fast as possible. And this is why he destroyed the tire, and this is why he ended up in 10th position or something in the first race. So, and that's my point. The spectators on the grandstand, do they really care about tires? I don't think so.
I don't think they do, Ivo, but I think they care about the fact that this was such a different race to normal, and then it went right down to the wire. Now, that being said, let's move on to the Super Bowl race, because this was the best race of the weekend. This was the only race of the weekend, really, because Bulliger is riding with one hand tied behind his back at the end of race one, just trying to survive. I would say as well, for Bulliger, the tactic worked. He hit his pace at the start of the race and he came away with 20 points as a championship leader. So, you know, you still have to say fair play to him. But the Super Bowl race, when we had that big group of riders, we had Ducatis, BMWs, Kawasaki's up there. I thought it was amazing. And it was the perfect illustration of why all of us get so excited to go to work on a Sunday, especially.
Yeah, I think it was also quite noticeable that it was another sprint race that delivered a really good race. Finally, the sprint seemed to be to be taking hold. We introduced sprints to try and make things a bit more exciting, a bit, okay, it's a gimmick, but to get the race results a bit closer. Well, that wasn't always the case and hasn't always been the case. The best rider, package, tyre, you name it, they would win just by a slightly smaller margin. But the sprints now seem to be doing it. Look at Australia. The race in Australia was fantastic. Why? Because we ended up effectively with having races cut in half. Every race was a sprint race, not by design, but by reality. And the entertainment level there was off the scale as well. So, yeah, maybe we do need to get the tyres to last 20 laps with everybody. But in any racing class, anywhere, if you go too fast at the beginning, you will have no tyre at the end. It's not just Superbike. It may be exacerbated by the things that we've talked about, but when I remember last year in MotoGP, I'm pretty sure...
Yeah, in Phillip Island somebody with got Jorge caught, Martin.
But Jorge Martin, he got caught by four riders right on the end. So, and that's very hard on tyres. So even when you've got tyres that are designed to go 20 hard laps, if you go too hard or choose the wrong one, you'll make a mess of it. And that's partly what happened. Yeah, we got a lot of tyre choice in Superbike, but they all seem to be the softer ones. So maybe we need to start making, as you say, taking away the softer ones and giving more choice than the harder ones.
It's one of those
ones. Or just say, guys, get on with it. You know, it's go and do that.
It's one of those ones, Gordo, that the development tyres, when they've come in, for me, the exciting, and Evo's laughing probably to himself now, the exciting
Evo's not happy.
Yeah, was when we brought in the bigger profile, because this was something that actually made you have to change the whole setup of the bike. And it did change an awful lot about what happened. The bigger riders, Vandermark immediately made a big step forward. You know, the tyre changes we're seeing now, I don't see that. You know, so the benefit of them, I think that it could be where the benefit of them could be towards Moto2 more than they're coming for us, but we'll wait and see for that. Evo, when you look at that Super Pole race, obviously the standout was the move on the last corner, but this was a great brawl all the way around. I thought there was a lot of moves being made on Andrea Iannone into turn 9, and you don't see a lot of moves into turn 9. There was riders catching each other by surprise. There was double overtakes into the Super Pole race. Lowe's came from third to lead on the Kawasaki into turn 5 and things like that. This was a race where everyone just went for it, and it was great.
Yeah, and a lot of people thought after the race that it was maybe a mistake from Alvaro in the last corner of the last lap, but in reality it wasn't a mistake. And when Gordo and me, when we talked to Alvaro after the race, he said, look guys, I can ride inside, outside, I could do whatever I want. I knew exactly the Toprak is coming, inside or outside. And Iannone said to us, oh, look, if there is a chance, then I will take the chance, and if I can win, then I will win. Okay, and I mean, what's better than a last corner decider?
Yeah, and when you looked at the line, I watched the race again on TV last night, and when you look at the line, Alvaro could have been a bit tighter and held it. But I think Toprak would pretty much have run around the outside, or at least had a go at it. So you can't win when somebody's as good at passing and as determined as they are. There was no dirty move or anything. Alvaro was frustrated, but if he stayed a bit tighter, he would at least have had a chance, because it's not that far down the straight before the finish line. So you can't overtake on your own push strips, you just crash. So he could have defended even more, lost speed, but with good acceleration, he probably could have at least fought for the race when he ended up being third.
I think it's one of those ones where you know Toprak's going to attack, but you also know it's coming down the inside. He's not trying to run around the outside. He's just going to leave it later.
Defend the inside. Exactly, Gordo. Defend the inside.
That's what I'm saying, is that like for Bautista, that's where he knew. If you know Toprak's behind you and you've got plus zero on your pit board for 10 laps, you can hear him closing in. You have to defend that inside line. Now, the one thing about Toprak is like Ayrton Senna was in Formula 1 in the 80s and 90s. We're going to have a crash unless you avoid the crash, but I'm putting my bike down here and it's up to you to take the avoiding action. And sooner or later, the other riders just need to clean Toprak out, because it's jail yard tactics from Toprak. So you need to do the same back. Now, saying that, it's a lot easier to say that here than sitting on the bike. But Toprak knows that everyone else knows what he's going to do, and they still can't defend it. So until there's a change from the other riders, Toprak keeps doing what he's doing. Now, I'm not complaining about that with last corner moves, Evo.
Well, Gordo, you go.
You've got to remember how Toprak has trained and does train. all those Turkish guys go to, you know, Sofoglu's private racetrack and basically spend all day passing and repassing and working out how to pass people in new places, making sure they're in position to pass all the time. It's what they do for all the other physical training and skill training they do. That's what they do on smaller bikes. They just spend all day, say, okay, you need to pass this guy and he needs to pass you back, two or three of them at a time. So the situation that Top Rack found himself in on the weekend is normal for him. Probably all the other riders only find themselves in that situation when they are racing. So the racecraft side of things is what those guys batter into each other, quite literally sometimes, compared to almost any other competitor on the track.
Yeah, as Gordo is saying, they're practicing all the time in Turkey on little bikes with not much CC, with used tires, using all the elbows, using everything they have. And for Toprak, it's simply, he's not a tactic boy. If there is a chance to pass, then at least he will try. And we all know he's the strongest guy on the brake. I mean, how would you like to outbrake a guy who is the strongest on the brake? Nearly impossible.
Yeah, and that's where you need to have your own racecraft for it. And Gordo, you're right. Like, that's what Toprak is trained up for, and that's what you look at. The Onchus, it's the same. The Turkish riders, that is their MO, but everyone needs to adapt to it as well. And if that's what they're doing, and what you've been doing up to this point doesn't work in defending that, like, you know, Top Rack's coming and it's up to you to stop them. And I thought that that was one of those things where, for me, Alvaro knew it was coming. And, you know, it's one of those situations where I think that if Alvaro had been able to hold off, it would have been a great win. If Toprak comes through, it's a better win and a better story. So everyone wants to see a move like that. I thought for Bautista, the problem was he loses that extra spot to Iannone.
Yeah, definitely. That was the big issue, was Iannone managed to come through and came through well. It shows that even after all those years missing, his racecraft's not too rusty either. But I think the interesting thing about the way the Turkish riders train is slightly different. But basically, the last time we had all the great American riders in 500 Grand Prix, now MotoGP, they all used to go to Kenny's Ranch on little 100cc or 125cc dirt bikes and do exactly the same thing. All they used to do was race each other all the time. Them, their pals, Chuck, everybody involved used to jump on the hundreds and just go for each other, just all the time. And that's what keeps you sharp. It keeps you hungry. You know, and if you get beaten into a corner by the same guy six times, you go away and find out how to do it again. So, yeah, I think there is definitely a lesson in how people approach the finer arts of passing people in the last corner when you're not expected to. The big story of the weekend for me is not just Top Rack's wins. It's being done in a BMW. It's historically been seen to be one of the bikes that really gives the tyres a harder time at the end. It's not just performance. He's not jumped in a bike and taken it to where it can go. He seems to have already subverted one of the problems that bike seemed to have had, under braking, entering corners and getting the power down.
I do think as well, though, BMW last year didn't get to show their true colours because of Annemar's injury, because Mikey in the winter was leading that project for the first two rounds. He was the fastest rider. He was the guy that was going to be spearheading that project last year. He breaks his leg. Suddenly his season's gone. Scott Redding has shown in what, this is his fifth season in World Superbikes. We know what Scott Redding is, and that's an inconsistent rider. We know that he's the best rider in the world on any given day and can dominate and can be really special at Most or a couple of other places, but he's not the week-in, week-out rider that you need, like a Top Rack. Now, Vandermark isn't that either. He's always been a very good rider, and then he's had some exceptional rounds and races. But when you look at BMW, they've made a step last year, and then Top Rack has pushed it even further. And then by hiring Top Rack, they had to invest in the test team. All those things have played a big factor, and I think it's been really, really noticeable as well how much Top Rack and Vandermark worked together. The Super Pole session, they went out in tandem. That wasn't happening last year with Redding and Vandermark. They were just going out to beat each other up in all likelihood, you know. And when you look at Top Rack and Vandermark, Vandermark qualifies in the second row of the grid. Race one, his pace dropped off with the softer front tire, so he changed the harder front for Sunday, and suddenly he was 5 seconds down the road from Top Rack, finishes fourth. Third or fourth's a great day for BMW. So there is progress being made, and I think Vandermark is taking advantage of that as well. I think for Assen, he's always so strong at home. You'd certainly expect that he's going to be able to spring a bit of a surprise there as well. But the one thing that probably was a big surprise this weekend, Evo, Alvaro Bautista came here, 6 wins in a row, unbeaten on the Ducati at this track. We all thought this was the one tailor-made for Alvaro. He comes away with only 1 race victory. Now, admittedly, he's helped himself a lot in the championship with 3 podiums, but this was a little bit of a surprise to see Buliga, especially in race 1, so strong. Pace dropped off at the end. Alvaro's wouldn't have. But you look at the Super Bowl session, and Alvaro qualifies on the 4th row of the grid, starts on the 5th row after a penalty, and he did a good job of damage limitation this weekend. But this was a weekend lost for Bautista, really, you'd say.
Okay, let's be fair with good old Alvaro. There was a massive influence this winter on his testing because of the injury from last November. And in Barcelona, we saw quite good that, as you said, he was 11th in the Super Bowl. Then he finished 3rd in the first race, again 3rd in the Super Bowl race, and then he won the 2nd main race. So for me, there was a clear progress, and you could see that he is feeling more and more good on his bike. On the other hand, he's saying there is still not the same feeling like last year and the year before, and he cannot really explain. He's all the time saying that it's not because of the extra weight on his bike, which is under 4 kilos, by the way. But I don't know if this is the truth or if Ducati or Dorna told him he needs to say this. So last year he said to us, you can feel even 500 grams on the bike. And now he's telling us that he's not feeling 4 kilos extra on the bike. So I don't really believe him, because for me, this is the only difference to last year, talking about the bike.
Yeah, the weight is an interesting one, because the Ducati as a bike is overweight. So therefore, Alvaro doesn't need to carry as much weight as you would have expected. So we were initially told that the bike weight was irrelevant. It was only a rider weight. But then when we got to Australia, suddenly it was a combined weight. So Alvaro's weight wasn't as big of an increase as what I think had been expected. And that's where it's going to be. Like, from what I had heard, it was in and around 2.5 kilos. So,
and we have to remember that basically Bautista's got back 500 revs from what he ended last year with, but that also causes a change on the bike. So the fact to find another slight setup change from the beginning of the year to utilise those 500 revs, but also have a small, but it's still there, weight penalty. And Alvaro was kept talking about his 2022 bike, and his 2023 bike, and being maybe a bit happier on the previous one, when last year's bike was supposedly much better than the previous one. So, yeah, I think we're looking at a guy who's trying to find more, but he's already maximised his package, and then people are changing the package for him. Remember halfway through the year when Alvaro was running away with a championship in his rookie year, and all they did was make a couple of changes. And then the psychology started coming in, but they wanted to start making changes to the bike. And basically he was like, look, we're winning every weekend, just leave it. But because it was a relatively new thing for Ducati, understandably, they started wanting to try things for next year. But it changed, he was riding on a razor's edge, and all the changes he made, plus his psychological, I don't like this, I don't want this, suddenly he was crashing every weekend, or and then other people crashing into him. And the next thing you know, he lost the championship. So I think that Ducati works really well, but you've got to get it to work perfectly. And Alvaro's always needed it to work just so. And when he does, he's been untouchable. So maybe the minute it's not quite the bike he's expecting, wanted, happy with again. Because it happened before. It happened halfway through that first season of his.
Yeah, it's a fickle bike. And that's always been the biggest issue for them. Just to move on as well, Evo, one of the big shocks of first 2 round, Yamaha and Jonathan Rea, because this was another weekend where it seemed that anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. Single lap pace is clearly an issue for Rea. We spoke to him on Thursday and he said, trying to grab this bike by the scruff of the neck with the qualifying tire and needing to set a lap time has been an issue for him. And it was again this week, qualified on the 5th row of the grid. And then he made a big mistake in race 1 on the starting grid. And the weekend just at least ended with some points and something positive in race two, where he was closing in on the top five. But this was another really tough weekend for him.
Yeah, and especially after the test, we all expected to see Jonathan much stronger. And he thought he will be much stronger, but in reality, they did not really sort out the problems. I mean, okay, he burned the clutch in the first race. Okay, let's say an experience, and we are talking about Jonathan Rea, so he should have enough experience. Super pole race was not great. An eighth place, I mean, how many championship points does he have now? So, yeah, I mean, he on paper, he has now one eighth place out of six races. This is nothing for Jonathan. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure that Australia and also Barcelona was super special circumstances. Let's wait for Assen, and I'm pretty sure that we will see another Jonathan Rea in Assen, and I'm pretty sure that Yamaha is not giving up, because in general, Barcelona was a super difficult weekend for all the Yamaha guys. The best result was, I think, fifth place from Locatelli in the first race. And they have six riders on a Yamaha. So, yeah.
Yeah, Gordo's gone through all of his notes to find out.
Yeah, it would help if he looked at the right ones. Yeah, he's got 8 points. He scored once out of five, six races.
Just when you look at it, Evo, obviously you mentioned the inexperience of Rea with the Yamaha. What I found really interesting was chatting to some of the other Yamaha riders. They said that when you go into the launch control mode, the dashboard gets taken over and you don't actually see the gear you're in as well. So for Rea with Kawasaki, he always had that big box on his dashboard that told him the gear he's in. Because if you remember, I think it was 2017, they had a lot of problems with false neutrals and a lot of problems with bad shifts. So they decided to change his dashboard to always show him the gear he's in. And I think that this was one of those things that on the Kawasaki, sitting on the grid, he would have known he's in first gear because it would say he's in first gear. Whereas from what one of the other Yamaha riders was telling me, with the R1, it just tells you you're in launch control mode and then you've just got to go for it. So I think this was probably a big factor for it. You'd imagine Yamaha will make a change to their dash going forward, because even though this is the first time it's happened, it could be the only time it happens. It should be the only time it happens. But Gordo, when you look at Rea on the Yamaha, he's obviously still trying to adapt to it. He's still trying to make that bike feel like a Kawasaki because he's not comfortable on it. And there was a few times in turn 10, for instance, and a couple of other times where he really did just look like he had a green bike underneath him. And that bike doesn't want to be ridden like that just yet for him. So this weekend was important to be able to show that there's still a lot that needs to be learned. And then Assen will be, you know, the next step in that. But I think that we all have to kind of look at it that even though Johnny's a six-time world champion, and like you said to him in Phillip Island, the reason that we're still talking to him is you're a six-time world champion. You know, Assen, place where he's had so much success in the past, that can be difficult as well, because there's a lot of riders really good at Assen now on bikes that they're much more comfortable with, on bikes that are more competitive.
Yeah, Johnny should be better than Assen just because of what he's done and because of the nature of the racetrack. A lot of those things that are critical for corner entry and so on, you're kind of reeling it in a wee bit and more than a lot of places. So yeah, it should come good for him there. If it doesn't, then they really are in trouble. But I think the thing that surprises me is I just thought Johnny, even if the bike had some issues, everything else, what we've seen Johnny do in the past is even when he didn't have a bike set up or anything that he didn't like, he could make the difference. He could just adapt. He's got a certain riding style he likes to ride that way, but he's had to change that. He's had powerful Kawasakis, he's had less powerful Kawasakis. He's ridden Hondas and he's the only guy that could win on it. And whenever it changed, he was always able to adapt straight away. For some reason, he's not able to do that now, whether it's him, the bike, both. And I think the biggest thing at play right now is that every single time he's come in and made a comment in the last 7 years, 8 years, the little guy with the clipboard listening to him has been able to go, aha, and he knows, we need to go a bit this way, a bit that way. When everybody inside that team is learning each other, so he's got a new crew chief, swapped over crew chief, different bike, different everything. Obviously, Jonathan's got no touchstones except his chief mechanic. Him and Andrew Pitt are great mates to everyone else, but they haven't worked together in that way. So he's maybe not got any comfortable position to fall back on, say, okay, well, he's set to here. He doesn't know where he is. whereas he did in Kawasaki, and Pere Riba knew exactly where he was and what he was maybe doing wrong, and he would tell him what he had to do different, and he would go, okay, Evo, sorry.
I mean, for Jonathan, when he made the decision to go to Yamaha, talking about the situation you're saying, it was like a lose-lose situation for him. Because just imagine, he would take Pere Riba with him. Then he would have a crew chief who understands him perfect, but Pere has no idea about the Yamaha. Now he has Andrew Pitt as the crew chief, and he understands the Yamaha perfectly, but he doesn't know anything about Jonathan. So I just think it will take some time, and they will figure it out, and then Andrew will understand Jonathan, and then they will know what to do, and then we will see Jonathan Ray back.
I think one thing as well, Gordon, the adaptability of Johnny has always been one of his big strengths, but he's also never had to adapt whenever the class is as competitive as it is now. If you think to whenever he moved from the Honda to the Kawasaki in 2015, a second on the grid in Superpole was probably down to P7 for most of that season, P6, whereas now a second takes you down to 15th, 16th, 17th place. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things, because right now in Superbikes, if you don't qualify well, you're doing nothing all weekend, because suddenly you're not in that lead group, you're in the second group or even the third group, and you're just never making progress from it. So I think that the competitiveness of the class probably highlights Johnny's challenge right now a lot more than anything else.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's also, when you're Johnny, that's very difficult to take, that you're giving your best and you're finishing 15th and things going wrong and crashing went because something's not right. That's very difficult to take after all the years of what he's had. I agree with you, the class is as competitive as ever been. So to go to the other extreme, another new rider changing bike, Bassani, all he said before weekend was, Axel Bassani on the Kawasaki, said, I need a good Super Pole. Said, if I can get a good Super Pole, I can be there with those guys. And when you actually looked at his times, I can't remember if it was the first race or the second race, but his lap times at the end were exactly the same as the guys at the front, more or less. And he was just so far back, he got nothing. Because the Super Pole, he needed to qualify well. And he's learning a bike, and he's obviously not the rider Jonathan Ray is and everything else. But the competitiveness of the class is, I think Petrucci was the one that said, there are weekends this year where you're going to be on the podium or 15th. And, you know, and even the best riders were going to finish 15th this year. And we've already seen that. You know, we've seen Batista struggle. We've seen Ray struggle. We haven't seen Toprak struggle. Read from that what you will. He's always managed to find a way different. But I think all Toprak was missing last year, as he said, was he needed more engine. He's got more engine. I think it maybe doesn't matter what bike you put him on, as long as he can stay in everybody's slipstream on the straight, using the better power this year than he had last, then he'll be all right. He'll find the rest. He'll make the difference.
Yeah, and I think that when we get to Assen, obviously it'll be a much more traditional weekend. We won't have to think about tyres too much in Assen. We'll just have to think about, is it going to rain? Is it going to snow? Is it going to do 30 degrees? You never know what it could be at Assen. But just to finish off the show, let's go through our winners and losers from the weekend. So, Gordo, who was your big winner from the Catalan round?
I mean, it's too obvious to say Toprak, but
it's never too obvious. I kinda, it's the right answer, Gordo.
I kind of have to say him. I mean, if Evo got Toprak the first time, and then I'm going to have him now. I'd say BMW, because they've proved the oldest adage in racing that the greatest performance aid to any motorcycle is the rider. They have made the correct rider choice this year, which they maybe haven't quite done, or bad luck has stopped them from doing several times. Somebody was daft enough to jump on it, and look at what they've done already. He wasn't so daft after all. So yeah, that biggest winner is BMW.
Evo, what about you? Who is your big winner?
Do they have only one choice or more?
Well, it's your big winner, Evo. You can't have multiple big winners.
Okay, so I need to go for top. I need to go.
We can give you a backup winner to be different to Gordo.
The winner is Toprak, definitely.
Who's your big loser from the weekend?
Yeah, the obvious choice would be Jonathan Ray. As a 6-time world champion, only a couple of points. But I go for Honda. This was, again, we can see all the big development BMW is doing, and we can see Honda, and nothing is happening. So for me, again, the big loser.
And yeah, just that this was one of their best tracks in the past, and then to come into this one and just have it continue to go the way it's gone, yeah, it's hard to argue with Honda. Gordo, what about you?
Yeah, that was going to be my pick, because we had the you know, it should be better now. They made big changes in the winter. We had the weirdness of Phillip Island. We had their home track, literally, and they were still really kind of nowhere, which is no, you know, and I've said it before, we need Honda to be in and winning and fighting, even inside, guaranteed inside the top five would be great. And they just don't seem anywhere near. It's really quite scary. They're all saying they're quite confident they're going to get there, but we don't see any evidence of that. I just don't understand why things are quite as far off, other than the fact that there's so much other better good competition. So again, you're not finishing 10th because there's now 5, 7, 9 better riders and bike combinations we've had for some time. But they should be further up. I know there's new people and new changes, but they should be finding improvements. They brought a new bike, theoretically, this year.
Yeah, they didn't come back this year or last year. They came back with a full HRC factory team in 2020.
Yeah, several years ago. It should be better by now. You know, and they've changed people at the top, they've changed people around. Clearly that wasn't the problem as far as I can see. You know, because nothing's changed. There's not been any step change. Does it? I mean, I'm sure the new people coming in are going to be able to get all they can out of the bike. So what is the problem? Is the problem the bike, inherently the design of the bike? Because it just seems to have the same issues over and over, keeping a line, letting the riders ride it freely without, you know, the risk of losing it. It's a bit struggle. I mean, Jonathan's, you know, Yamaha is, again, they just look lost and they shouldn't be given all the thing. But I kind of have to say Honda. It's got to be Honda.
Yeah, I think for me, I'll go with Yamaha, but not just because of Ray. It was top five for Locatelli in race one, and then it was 8th and 7th for their performances on Sunday as their top performer. So 5th, 8th, 7th, I think we were all expecting more from them in Catalonia, even if they talk about it being a difficult track for them. They've still had a lot of podiums there. They've still had a lot of pace there, but they just didn't this weekend. So I'll go with Yamaha as my losers from this weekend. And I'll be honest, though, my big winner from this week is you, Evo, because you're off on your holidays in a few hours' time.
Absolutely. I'm on the sunny side of life.
You will be soon. I don't know if you are right now, but me and Gordo certainly aren't. It's torrential rain to return to here. Although saying that, the rain in Catalonia on Monday and Tuesday was pretty severe as well. So I think just getting out of Europe is a good idea. Gordo, you've just had your holiday. So back to sunny Scotland. Holiday.
Yeah, it was a great day when I came back. It was beautiful. And then, it's now turned a little bit. It's become a bit normal for here, which is not good. Yeah, it's a bit grey. I'm quite happy staying in the house today.
Yeah, it's a bit like that here in Ireland as well. And luckily, I've got a busy day. Record this pod. Then we've got the MotoGP pod coming up as well. So keep yourselves ready for that to drop pretty soon as well, looking back at Portimao. And then, obviously, keep up to date on patreon.com/paddockpasspodcast. Gordo, we've had quite a few of your Gordo Remembers stories, and I think that the last one was really popular with everyone being able to get themselves up to date on who your superbike stars of the past were, and I think that was a really interesting one. We spoke for what was supposed to be 20 minutes, Gordo, and we ended up talking for the best part of an hour about your top 10 superbike riders that then became top 15, that they just became, and these are just the best superbike riders we've ever seen.
And it's impossible to do. If I did it again tomorrow, I'd have a different number in a different order. It's just one of those things, isn't it? What's your favourite song? Changes, doesn't it? Changes.
I'll tell you what, my Spotify would indicate that it hasn't changed for about 6 years. So I won't admit to what that song is, because I think Evo there with his sweetest death metal t-shirt probably would be disowning me as a friend. But Evo, it's been great having you on the pond again. And we all really enjoy your insight all the way through the year.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
And Gordo, as ever, thanks very much for joining us on the pod.
Cheers, always a pleasure. Love it.
Big thanks to Renthal Street and to Fly Racing as well for supporting the Paddock Pass podcast through the course of the year. And just tune in on your normal podcast channels to get all of our latest shows.